If you get hot, then you must get cool. Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? Oh, what you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? Oh, what you gonna do when they come for you? You chuck it on that one, you chuck it on this one. You chuck it on your mother and you chuck it on your father. You chuck it on your brother and you chuck it on your sister. You chuck it on that one and you chuck it on me. Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
All right, welcome back to the Valley Report. Quick, Roger Hoach coming to you live from the Valley of the Sun. So, yes, out of 38 police departments investigated, all but three had no police complaint form. And one officer, a Sergeant Clay, as you heard, threatened jail time when the investigator walked out. Sergeant Clay followed him and told him to get out of his city. When the investigator challenged his statement, Clay then arrests him. Channel 4 News went in and confronted Clay, who stuttered, stammered, and danced all over the reporter's questions, and then stated that the investigator wasn't under arrest, even though Clay handcuffed him and threw him in a jail cell, and he claimed he just wanted him to, quote, calm down and get an understanding, unquote. But he actually was under arrest, and they had issued him a court date. Now, these tactics and arrests are going on all over the country, simply for asking for a complaint form. And then we've got the fixed court trials, should they go that far, regardless, unless there's a plea bargain taken, regardless of whether you are in the United States or Canada or many other countries in the world. And oh, by the way, did you know that the documentary, The Greatest Story Never Told, has been banned in 22 countries across the world? Gee, I wonder why. Maybe this has something to do with it. Just try to deny any false story of total propagated nonsense and see what happens. Many cases in point. Fred Leuchter asked for a joint scientific investigation. Fred Leuchter was the forensic investigator who went to Germany and investigated the supposed death camps with the gas chambers, and came back and determined that it was all a fraud. But he asked for a joint scientific investigation after the fact into the Holocaust as a whole. It never happened. Instead, he was targeted by Jewish extremists, and his career was ruined. And since its publication, the Leuchter Report has earned legendary status in the world of Holocaust revision, denying the Holocaust as a criminal offense in many countries. 22, to be exact. The same 22, I'm sure, that have banned that book. Denying the Holocaust is a criminal offense. It is the only event in history to be enforced by law. You don't believe me? Just ask Jürgen Graf. He spent 10 months imprisoned in Switzerland. Gerhard Forster, 12 months imprisoned in Switzerland. Gaston Armand Amoudres, 1 year in Switzerland. David Irving, 1 year in prison in Austria. Germar Rudolph, 2.5 years in Germany. Wolfgang Frohlich, Austrian court, 6 years, third offense. Sylvia Stoltz, 3.5 years in Germany. Horst Mahler, 5 years in Germany. Dirk Zimmermann, 9 months in Germany. And most famously, of which I'm going to get into a little bit more here, Ernst Zundel, 5 years in Germany, 9 months in Canada. But before I do that, two things. First of all, Steve Elkins sent me a quick thing that I'm going to get into my email. He said that he sent me an article relevant to my program today, which I'm going to see if I can get into. But let's go to Alan in Texas. Alan, you're on with Michael. Go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon, Michael.
Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Kind of serendipitous, you were talking about Israel over there and, you know, who trains the police forces, because was it yesterday or the day before? I was thinking that exact same thing. You know, I sit here and watch, you know, international satellite. And, you know, like clockwork, every Friday, you know, there's protests over there. So, I mean, what better place is a training ground to learn, you know, police crackdown tactics than, because all these guys are wearing gas masks or you know, face masks or something, so you really can't tell, you know, if they're white, if they're Israeli, if they're, you know, Mexican or what. So,
mm-hmm.
I'm agree with you on that. And also, Michael, I agree, we are in a lot of trouble. You know, it's just gotten to the point of ridiculous. It's who you know. If you happen to know someone lucky enough, you might get out of something. But it's not a justice system at all.
No, it's not. It's as Clint Richardson says, it's an administrative court system, and it's a two-tiered system. As Steve said, Steve Elkins, it's a two-tiered system that You know, we are the underlings, we are the sheeple, we are the goyim, and it is the upper echelon elites that are the ones that get the walk. And we see this happen. We saw it happen with Hillary Clinton and James Comey saying, well, you know, she was grossly negligent, and they changed that to some other word that omitted grossly negligent because that was a legal violation of some statute. I don't know. So they had to change that. So there obviously on paper was no violation. But this is ridiculous. And again, and it is imperative, Alan, and it's more important than ever that we, the awakened Americans at RBN, wake these people up to understand what is being done to us. If we don't, we're all going to perish.
Well, you know, Michael, a lot of people ask me all the time, it's like, well, how do we stop this thing? And I've really, you know, I hate to sound fatalistic, but, you know, I'm of the opinion, Michael, that, you know, we can't stop it. That all we can hope to do is try to tell as many people as we can to move to the back of the train before it hits the, you know, reinforced concrete wall that we're coming up on at 100 miles an hour. And, you know, if we can get enough people, good people, far enough back that'll listen to us and bypass all the sheep that are waiting for the conductor to tell them, oh, we're doing fine, people, don't worry about it. You know, if we can get enough people to move to the back, we might be able to cushion a blow for some of us. All of us are going to get hurt a little bit, I think, in this, because it's gotten to the point of ridiculous. And, Michael, when it's to the point of we're in Fredericksburg, Texas, if you want to have a Girl Scout bakes cookie sale, you know, on the Mark plots in this town, you have to be okay by the Department of Homeland Security.
Isn't that an outrage, Alan? You know, I've spent time in Fredericksburg, you know, a great little town, great little quaint town down there, and they're coming there, they're not arresting these girls for making Girl Scout cookies, are they?
Not at this point, as long as they have the proper license and registration and all, of course, I'm sure.
But, oh, my God.
It's just gotten, you know, like I said, how even the stupid people, very ignorant people, a lot of them are stupid, too. But that are watching the mainstream media, how they're not even just starting to go, huh? You know, it's just.
No, I know, I know, Alan. It's very frustrating, and you know, I try to be optimistic. It's not an easy thing to do to read this, report this, and remain optimistic about life in as a whole. Because as I go through this, just like yesterday in the bank, you know, I walked out and I scratched my head. Goes, you know, what happened to the country I used to live in?
Comply, you know, Michael. Comply.
You know, Yeah.
You're not resist. All right, put on the right glasses, and it's so easy to see it. It's like the movie. I mean, they show us, you know, kind of how the real world works. You know, if you put on the right glasses, you can see. You know, you must comply. Do not resist. The state is your god.
You're talking about the movie They Live. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
I sat in a courtroom and talking about representing yourself. What do you do when the judge just flat out says, Miss So-and-so, if you try to represent yourself, you will do a year in jail. I mean, it was a threat as far as I could tell. But, you know, of course it wasn't a threat, you know, if you interview anyone that's in the power structure.
Well, Alan, hold on a second. What is this? I can't deal with this. These are these people that are consistently trying to sell me something. Shut up. How do I get this to stop? Turn it off.
You know, I'm still a caveman. I don't even have one of those things in my life, and it's amazing when you stand on the outside and you can look and see how much. And I know it's almost become a necessity for everyone, but to see the enslavement that the computers and the cell phones and everything have become when you don't have one, it's I wish I could admire what bitches have done.
But Alan, if I didn't have one, you wouldn't be listening to me right now.
Right. But, you know, I had a peaceful life before there was the internet and computers and everything, too, you know.
As Jerry Spence says, what happens at the day when they knock on your door, you know, if you have no warning? I don't, you know, I could go into this. I can't. I don't want to do it right now because I have a lot more.
I'll let you get on with your show, Michael. All right. I've taken enough of your time. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. I appreciate it. Okay. So getting back to this. All of these people imprisoned all over the world for simply calling out the lie for what it is. Documented evidence, forensic proof that the big lie that these Zionists hide behind isn't true. And then we've got Ernst Zundel. Let's take another look at his trial. In Canada, by the way. Back in May 13th, 88, Zundel was sentenced by Judge Ronald Thomas of the District of Ontario in Toronto to 9 months in prison for having distributed a revisionist booklet. did 6 million really die? Just questioning. And I put forth the evidence in that book. Now, he lived in Toronto where he worked as an artist and an advertising man. And he was a native of Germany. He kept his German citizenship. His life had known serious upsets from the day when, in about 1981, he began the distribution of that book, Did 6 Million Really Die? It was a revisionist booklet by Richard Harwood. And the booklet was first published back in 1974 in Great Britain, where a year later it was the focus of a lengthy controversy in the literary journal Books and Bookman. At the investigation of the Jewish community in South Africa, it was later banned in that country. And in Canada, during the earlier trial in 1985, Zundel had been sentenced to 15 months in prison, but that sentence was thrown out in 1987, and a new trial began in January of 1988. But the first trial lasted 7 weeks, and the jury found Ernst not guilty regarding the letter he had himself written, but he was guilty of distributing the Harwood booklet. He was sentenced by Judge Hugh Locke to 15 months in prison. The German consulate in Toronto confiscated his passport, and the West German government prepared a deportation action against him. In Germany itself, West German authorities had already carried out a series of large-scale police raids on the houses of all his German correspondents. And in 1987, the United States forbade him entry to its territory. But in spite of all of that, Zundel had won a media victory day after day. For 7 weeks, the entire English-speaking Canadian media covered the trial with its spectacular revelations. The public learned that the revisionists had first-class documentation and arguments, while the exterminationists were in desperate straits. Who was their expert? Raoul Hilberg. The prosecution expert in that first trial was Raoul Hilberg, an American professor of Jewish descent and author of the standard reference work, The Destruction of the European Jews. In 1961 it was written, which Paul Rassinier discussed in Le Drame des Juifs Européens, The Drama of the European Jew. Hilberg began his testimony by explaining, without interruption, his theory about the, and I emphasize, his theory about the extermination of the Jews. He was then cross-examined by Zundel's lawyer, Doug Christie, who was assisted by Kelty Zubko and the writer of this article. Right from the start, it was clear that Hilberg, who was the world's leading authority on the Holocaust, had never examined a single concentration camp, not even Auschwitz. He had still not examined any camp in 1985 when he announced the imminent appearance of a new edition of his main work in three volumes. Revised, corrected, and augmented. And although he did visit Auschwitz in 1979 for a single day as part of a ceremonial appearance, he did not bother to examine either the buildings or the archives. In his entire life, he has never seen a gas chamber, either in its original condition or in ruins. And for an historian, even ruins can tell tales. On the stand, he was forced to admit that there had never been a plan, a central organization, a budget or supervision for what he called the policy of the extermination of the Jews. He also had to admit that since 1945, the Allies have never carried out an expert study of the weapon of the crime. That is to say, of the homicidal gas chamber. No autopsy report has established that even one inmate was ever killed by poison gas. Now, Hilberg said that Hitler gave the orders for the extermination of the Jews, but Himmler gave the order to halt the extermination on November 25th, 1944. But Hilberg could not produce these orders, and the defense asked him if he still maintained the existence of the Hitler orders in the new edition of his book. He dared to answer yes. He thereby lied and even committed perjury. And in the new edition of his work, with a preface dated September 1984, Hilberg systematically deleted any mention of an order by Hitler. And in this regard, see the review by Christopher Browning, the revised Hilberg, Simon Wiesenthal Center, annual of 1986, page 294, when he was asked by the defense to explain how the Germans had been able to carry out an undertaking as enormous as the exterminations of millions of Jews without any kind of plan, without any central agency, without any blueprint or budget, Hilberg replied that in the various Nazi agencies there had been an, and I quote, an incredible meeting of the minds, a consensus mind reading by a far-flung bureaucracy, unquote. The witness Arnold Friedman, the prosecution countered on the testimony of the survivors, and these survivors were chosen with care, folks. They were supposed to testify that they had seen with their own eyes preparations for and the carrying out of homicidal gassings. And since the war, in a series of trials, like those at Nuremberg, or Jerusalem, or Frankfurt, such witnesses have never been lacking. However, as noted, no lawyer for the defense has ever had the courage or the competence necessary to cross-examine these witnesses on the gassings themselves. And for the first time in Toronto in 1985, one lawyer, Doug Christie, dared to ask for explanations. He did it with the help of topographical maps and building plans, as well as scholarly documentation on both the properties of the gases supposedly used and also on the capacities for cremation, whether carried out in crematory ovens or on pyres. Not one of these witnesses stood the test, and especially not Arnold Friedman. Despairing of his case, he ended by confessing that he had indeed been in Auschwitz-Birkenau, where he had never had to work except once unloading potatoes. But that, as regarding gassings, he had relied on what others had told him. The witness Rudolf Verba was internationally known, a Slavic Jew imprisoned at Auschwitz and at Birkenau. He said that he had escaped from the camp in April of 1944 with Fred Wetzler. After getting back to Slovakia, he dictated a report about Auschwitz and Birkenau and on their crematories and on their gas chambers. And with help from Jewish organizations in Slovakia, Hungary, and Switzerland, his report reached Washington, where it served as the basis for the United States government's famous War Refugee Board report, published in November of 1944. And since then, every Allied organization charged with the prosecution of war crimes and every Allied prosecutor in a trial of war criminals has had available this official version of the history of those camps. With Verba later became a British citizen and published his autobiography under the title of I Cannot Forgive. This book, published in 1964, was actually written by Alan Bestick, who, in his preface, testified to the considerable care by Rudolf Verba for each detail and to the meticulous and almost fantastic respect he revealed for accuracy. And on November 30th, 1964, Verba testified at the Frankfurt Auschwitz trial. Then he settled in Canada and became a Canadian citizen. He's been featured in various films about Auschwitz, particularly Shaw and Claude Lanzmann, and everything went well for him until the day at the Zundel trial in 1985, when he was cross-examined mercilessly by Christie. He was then shown to be an imposter. It was revealed that he had completely made up the number and location of the gas chambers and the crematories in his famous 1944 report, and his 1964 book opened with a purported January 1943 visit by Himmler to Birkenau to inaugurate a new crematorium with a gas chamber. And actually, the last visit by Himmler to Auschwitz took place in July of 1942 and in January of 1943. The first of the new crematories was still far from finished, thanks apparently to some special gift of memory that he called special mnemonic principles or special mnemonical method, and to a real talent for being everywhere at once. Verba had calculated that in the space of 25 months from April of 42 till April of 44, the Germans had gassed 1,765,000 Jews at Birkenau alone, including 150,000 Jews from France. But in 1978, Serge Klarsfeld, in his memorial to the deportation of the Jews from France, had been forced to conclude that for the entire length of the war, the Germans had deported a total of 75,721 Jews from France to all their concentration camps. The gravest aspect of this is that the figure of 1.765 million Jews gassed at Birkenau had also been used in a document at the main Nuremberg trial. Attacked on all sides by Zundel's lawyer, the imposter had no other recourse to invoke in Latin the licentia poeterum, or poetic license. In other words, the right to engage in fiction. His book had just been published in France. This edition had presented as a book by Rudolf Verba with Alan Bestick. It no longer includes the enthusiastic preface by Alan Bestick and the short introduction by Emil Kopperman. Well, I'll get to that note when we get back. Stick around, more to come.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
You've probably heard about all the great benefits of goat milk soap. But did you know? Some companies take shortcuts. At Old New England Soap, we make our organic goat's milk soap using 36% goat's milk. That's 17% more than most others. Our bars are larger, so they last longer, producing lots of lather packed with vitamins. And our soap is a natural moisturizer that smooths dry and damaged skin.
All right, folks, we're back with the American Awakening. Michael Herzog, your host. Emil Kopperman. Oh, by the way, before I go any further, Steve in Florida, you said you'd sent me an email that kind of related to what I was talking about. I didn't receive it. I went in my mailbox and I couldn't find it. So resend it if you can. I'll see if I can get it in. See if I can fit it in. So anyway, Emil Kopperman noted that with the approval of Rudolf Verba, the two appendices from the English edition. The English email Skype. Oh, okay. All right, very good. Thank you. Anyway, the two appendices from the English edition have been removed. Nothing is said about the fact that those two appendices had already caused Verba serious problems in 1985 at the Toronto trial. Let me take a break here for just a second and see if I can pull. He said that he sent it to the American Awakening. Well, if he sent it to the – just a minute. I'm talking – he sent it to the American Awakening email. Okay, well – I'll probably not get that one for a while. Let me do this. How do I do this? If you can tell him, I'm talking to Dan right now, folks. I'm sending you my email address right now. Dan, have him send it to this address and I'll get it. Okay. I'm forwarding that to you right now. And let's continue with this. So let's go into the second trial. January 1987, a five-judge appeals court decided to throw out the 1985 verdict against Zundel for some very basic reasons. Judge Hugh Locke had not allowed the defense any influence in the jury selection process, and the jury had been misled by the judge on the very meaning of the trial. Now,
According to this writer, he's attended many trials in his life, including some carried out in France during the period of the purge at the end and after World War II. And never has he encountered a judge so partial, so autocratic, and violent as Judge Hugh Locke. An Anglo-Saxon law offers many more guarantees than French law, but it only takes one man to pervert the best of systems. Judge Locke was such a man. The second trial began January 18, 1988, under the direction of Ronald Thomas, Judge Ronald Thomas, who is a friend, it seems, of Judge Locke. Judge Thomas was often angry and was frankly hostile to the defense, but he had more finesse than his predecessor. The ruling by the 5-judge appeal court also inhibited him somewhat. Judge Hugh Locke had imposed numerous restrictions on free expression by the witnesses and experts for the defense. For example, he forbade the writer of this to use any of the photos he had taken at Auschwitz. He said he had no right to use arguments of a chemical, a cartographical, or an architectural nature, even though he had been the first person in the world to publish the plans for the Auschwitz and Birkenau crematories. I was not allowed to talk about either the American gas chambers or the aerial reconnaissance photos of Auschwitz and Birkenau. Even the testimony of the eminent chemist William Lindsay was cut short. Judge Ronald Thomas did allow the defense more freedom, but at the outset of the trial, he made a decision at the request of the prosecution that would tie the hands of the jury. Raoul Hilberg, the guy that had testified in the first trial and got blown up by Doug Christie, he refused to appear again. Yes, there was a misfortune that awaited prosecutor John Pearson. Hilberg, in spite of repeated requests, refused to appear again. I wonder why. The defense tore him up so bad the first time that he wasn't going to show up for a second grilling. The defense, having heard rumors of an exchange of correspondence between Pearson and Hilberg, demanded and got the publication of the letters they exchanged, in the particular of the confidential letter by Hilberg, which did not hide the fact that he had some bitter memories of his cross-examination in 1985. He feared being questioned again by Doug Christie on the same points. And to quote the exact words of his confidential letter, Hilberg wrote that he feared every attempt to entrap me by pointing out any seeming contradiction, however trivial the subject might be, between my earlier testimony and an answer that I might have given in 1988. In fact, as I have already mentioned, Hilberg had committed perjury, and he may have feared being charged with that crime. Christopher Browning, the prosecution witness. In place of Hilberg, there came his friend Christopher Browning, an American professor who specializes in the Holocaust. Admitted as an expert witness and paid for several days at the rate of $150 an hour by the Canadian taxpayer, Browning tried to prove that the Harwood pamphlet was a tissue of lies and that the attempt to exterminate the Jews was a scientifically established fact. He had cause to regret that experience, however, because during cross-examination, the defense used his own arguments to destroy him. In the course of those days, people saw the tall and naive professor, who had strutted while he stood testifying, seated, shrunken in size, behind the witness stand like a schoolboy caught in a mistake. With a faint and submissive voice, he ended up acknowledging that the trial had definitely taught him something about historical research. I hear the music. I'll be back in three and continue with this. Michael Herzog, The American Awakening. Stick around. More to come.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
You've probably heard about all the great benefits of goat milk soap. But did you know? Some companies take shortcuts. At Old New England Soap, we make our organic goat's milk soap using 36% goat's milk. That's 17% more than most others. Our bars are larger, so they last longer, producing lots of lather packed with vitamins. And our soap is a natural moisturizer that smooths dry and damaged skin. Order online at oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. You've tried the rest. Now try the best. Oldnesoap.com.
Water-based soaps on supermarket shelves use harsh chemical acids to break down dead skin cells. And that's just not good for you. At Old New England Soap, our soaps are made without chemical ingredients, contain no alcohol or petroleum products, and use 85% organic materials and carry the USDA's organic certification. Try some today. Go to oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. Oldnesoap.com.
I'm getting older and noticing that my body just doesn't work as well as it used to. So I like to keep fit as possible by hitting the gym a few times a week. Recently, I started having a nagging bicep pain, and it got so bad I couldn't even lift the weights. When I was complaining about it to a friend, he told me about Angioprim. He said chelation helps remove toxins, heavy metals, and cholesterol in veins and arteries that may cause blockages. You know, after just 1 week of taking Angioprim, the pain was gone, and now I'm back in the gym full strength. Scientific research proves the active ingredient in Angioprim has superior oral chelation action that helps promote cardiovascular health. So to learn more, go to angioprim.com. That's Angioprim.com, or talk to a trained consultant. Call Angioprim toll free at 877-882-7221. You'll feel better with more energy. Call 877-882-7221 or go to the website angioprim.com.
Do you know there is an ongoing war right here in America? Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT-TODAY.
Well, it's all right, riding around in the breeze. Well, it's all right, if you live the life you please. Well, it's all right, doing the best you can. Well, it's all right, as long as you lend a hand.
You can sit around and wait for the phone to ring, waiting for someone to tell you everything.
And we're back. Okay, thank you. Anyway, getting back to this. Yes, following the example of Raoul Hilberg, the new, quote, expert witness Browning had not examined any concentration camps. He had not visited any facility with gas chambers. He had never thought of asking for an expert study of the weapon of the crime. And in his writings, he made much of homicidal gas vans. But he was not able to refer to any authentic photograph, any plan, no technical study, or any expert study. He was not aware that German words like Gaswagen and Spezelwagen and Slausenswagen, delousing van, could have perfectly innocent meanings. His technical understanding was nil. He had never examined the wartime aerial reconnaissance photos of Auschwitz. He was unaware of all the torture undergone by Germans such as Rudolf Hess, who had spoken of gassings. He knew nothing of the doubts expressed about some of Himmler's speeches or about the Goebbels diary. A great follower of the trials of war criminals, Browning had only questioned the prosecutors, never the defense lawyers. His ignorance of the transcript of the Nuremberg trial, was disconcerting. He had not even read what Hans Frank, the former governor general of Poland, had said before the Nuremberg tribunal about his diary and about the extermination of the Jews. That was inexcusable. As a matter of fact, Browning claimed to have found irrefutable proof of the existence of a policy of exterminating the Jews in the Frank diary. He had discovered one incriminating sentence. He did not know that Frank had given the tribunal an explanation of that kind of sentence, chosen beforehand from the hundreds of thousands of sentences in a personal and administrative journal of 11,560 pages. And furthermore, Frank had spontaneously turned over his diary to the Americans when they came to arrest him. The sincerity of the former governor general is so obvious to anyone who reads his deposition that Christopher Browning, invited to hear the content, did not raise the least objection. And one last humiliation awaited him. And for the sake of his thesis, he invoked a passage from the well-known protocol of the Wannsee Conference of the 20th of January, 1942. He had made his own translation of the passage, a translation that was seriously an error. And at that point, his thesis collapsed. Finally, his own personal explanation of a policy of the extermination of the Jews was the same as Hilberg's. Everything was explained by the nod of Adolf Hitler. In other words, the Fuhrer of the German people did not need to give any written or spoken order for the extermination of the Jews. It was enough for him to give a nod at the beginning of the operation and for the rest a series of signals, and that was understood. Well, the judge asked the prosecutor if he would call any survivors to the witness stand. The prosecutor answered no. The experience of 1985 had been too embarrassing. The cross-examination had been devastating. It is regrettable that the experience that the trial of Klaus Barbie in France in 1987 and at the trial of John Demjanjuk in Israel in 1987 and 88, no defense lawyer has followed Douglas Christie's example in the first Zundel trial of 1985. Christie had shown that by carefully questioning witnesses about the gassing process itself, one could destroy the very foundation of the extermination camp myth. And most of the witnesses and experts for the defense were as precise and concrete as people like Hilberg or Browning had been imprecise and metaphysical. The Swede, Dietlieb Felderer, showed about 380 slides of Auschwitz and of the other camps in Poland. The American, Mark Weber, who I've had on my show, whose knowledge of the documents is impressive, engaged in clarifications of several aspects of the Holocaust, in particular the Einsengruppen. The German Tugendhat Rudolph dealt with the Lodz ghetto and visits by the ICRC delegates, and at the end of 1941, two Ossets, Majanek, and other camps. Thijs Christofferson had been in charge of the agricultural research enterprise in Auschwitz's region in 1944 and visited the Birkenau camp several times to requisition personnel there and never noticed the horrors usually described. On the witness stand, he repeated point by point that he had written about the camp starting in 1973 with a 19-page report. The Austrian-born Canadian Maria van Houwarden was interned at Birkenau starting in 1942. She saw nothing, either close up or from a distance, that resembled mass murder, although she confirmed that many of the inmates had died of typhus. The American Bradley Smith, a member of the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, spoke about his experience in more than 100 question-and-answer interviews on American radio and television on the Holocaust issue. The Australian Emile Lacoute commented on the famous Mueller document, which since December of 87 has thrown the Austrian authorities into disarray. And that document, dated October 1, 1948, revealed that even then, Allied commissions of inquiry had already rejected the stories of homicidal gassings. In a whole series of camps, including Dachau, Ravensbrück, Strutorf, Stutthof, Sagengusen, and Mauthausen in Austria, the document specifically confirms that confessions of Germans had been extorted by torture and that testimonies by former inmates were false. Dr. Russell Barton recounted his horrifying discovery of the camp at Bergen-Belsen at the time of liberation. Until that moment, he had believed in a deliberate program of extermination. Then he noted the fact that in an apocalyptic Germany, the piles of corpses and the walking skeletons were the result of the frightful conditions of an overcrowded camp ravaged by epidemics and almost entirely deprived of medicine, food, and water because of the Allied bombings. The German Udo Wallindi outlined the many forgeries he had discovered in wartime atrocity photographs and other documents, either altered or forged by a team headed by a British propagandist called Sefton Delmar. J.G. Berg, a Jew who lives in Munich, told of his experiences in the war and confirmed that there had never been any policy for the extermination of the Jews by the Nazis. Academics, like the Chinese professor Dr. K.T. Fan, a Marxist, and Dr. Gary Botting, who lost his teaching position at Red Deer College in Alberta as a result of testifying at the Zundel trial in 1985. He testified that the Harwood booklet was essentially a work of opinion and hence not subject to legal prohibition. Jürgen Neumann, a close associate and friend of Zundel, testified as to Zundel's state of mind when the booklet first was published, and Ernst Nielsen testified on the obstacles he encountered at the University of Toronto to open research on the Holocaust. Ivan Lagasse, the director of the crematory at Calgary, and demonstrated the practical impossibility of the numbers alleged by Hilberg to have been cremated at Auschwitz. For the writer's part, he appeared as an expert witness for nearly 6 days. He concentrated particularly on his investigation of the American gas chambers, and he recalled that Zyklon B is essentially hydrocyanic acid and that it is with this gas that certain American penitentiaries execute those who have been condemned to death. So in 1945, the Allies should have asked specialists on American gas chambers to examine the buildings at Auschwitz and elsewhere, which were supposed to have been used to gas millions of people. And since 1977, this writer has had the following idea: which one deals with a vast historical problem like that of the reality or the legend of the Holocaust, one must strive to get to the core of the problem. And in this case, the central problem is Auschwitz, and the core of that problem is a space of 275 square meters, the 65 square meters of the gas chamber of Crematorium 1 at Auschwitz and Birkenau, the 200 square meters of the gas chambers of Crematorium 2. And in 1988, his idea remained the same. Let us have expert studies of those 275 square meters, and we will have an answer to the vast problem of the Holocaust. Remember, Fred Luchter tried to get that investigation, and they shot it down, and they vilified the guy. This writer said he showed the jury his photos of the gas chamber at the Maryland State Penitentiary in Baltimore, as well as his plans for the Auschwitz gas chambers, and he underlined the physical and chemical impossibilities of the latter ones. The judge asked the prosecutor if he would call any survivors to the witness stand, as I said, and the prosecutor answered no, because 1985 had been too embarrassing. Now, all of that, and he's still convicted? They threw out Luchter's testimony? Ernst Zundel, in possession of the correspondence he had exchanged in 77 and 78 with the six American penitentiaries outfitted with gas chambers, gave attorney Barbara Kolaska the job of getting in touch with the chief wardens of those penitentiaries in order to see if one of them would agree to appear in court and explain how a real gas chamber operates. Bill Armentrout, the chief warden of the penitentiary at Jefferson City, Missouri, agreed to testify, and in doing so pointed out that no one in the USA was more knowledgeable about the functioning of gas chambers than Fred Luchter, an engineer from Boston. He went to visit Luchter on February 3rd and 4th of 88, and he found that he had never asked himself any questions about the gas chambers. And in the German camps, he had simply believed in their existence, and after he began to show him the files, he became aware of the chemical and physical impossibility of German gassings, and he agreed to examine the documents in Toronto. After that, at Zundel's expense, he left for Poland with a secretary, his wife, a draftsman and video cameraman, and an interpreter. He came back and drew up a 192-page report, including appendices. He also brought back 32 samples taken, on one hand from the crematories of Auschwitz and Birkenau at the site of the so-called homicidal gassings, and on the other hand, in the disinfection gas chamber at Birkenau. His conclusion was simple. There had never been any homicidal gassings at Auschwitz, Birkenau, or Majdanek. And on April 20th and 21st, 1988, Luchter appeared on the witness stand in the Toronto courtroom. He told the story of his investigation and presented it with his conclusions. He said he was convinced that during those 2 days, he was an eyewitness to the death of the gas chamber myth, a myth which, in his opinion, had entered its dead throes at the Sorbonne Colloquium on Nazi Germany and the extermination of the Jews, where the organizers themselves began to grasp, but there was no proof of the existence of gas chambers. And in the Toronto courtroom, the emotions were intense, in particular among the friends of Sabina Citron. Ernst Zundel's friends were also moved, but for a different reason. They were witnessing the veil of the great swindle being torn away. As for the writer, he felt both relief and melancholy. Relief because a thesis that he had defended for so many years was at last fully confirmed. And melancholy because he had fathered the idea in the first place. He had even, with the clumsiness of a man of letters, presented physical, chemical, topographical, and architectural arguments, which he now saw summed up by a scientist who was astonishingly precise and thorough, i.e. Fred Leuchter. Would people one day remember the skepticism he had encountered, even from other revisionists? Just before Fred Leuchter, Bill Armantrout had been on the witness stand where he confirmed in every detail what he had said to the jury about the extreme difficulties of a homicidal gassing, not to be confused with a suicidal or accidental gassing. Ken Wilson, a specialist in aerial photographs, had shown that the homicidal gas chambers of Auschwitz and Birkenau did not have the gas evacuation chimneys, which would have been indispensable. He also showed that he had been right in the accusing Sergei Klarsfeld and Jean-Claude Pressac of falsifying the map of Birkenau in the Auschwitz album of Sewell Publishers in 1983. Those authors, in order to make the reader believe that groups of Jewish women and children surprised by the photographer between crematories 2 and 3 could not go any farther and were thus going to end up in the gas chambers. And those crematories had simply been eliminated from the math and the path, which in reality led up to the central sauna, a large shower facility located beyond the zone of the crematories where those women and children were actually going. James Roth, the director of a laboratory in Massachusetts, then testified on the analysis of the 32 samples, the origin of which he was unaware of. All the samples taken in the homicidal gas chambers contained a quantity of cyanide which was either unmeasurable or infinitesimal, while the sample from the disinfection chamber, taken for comparison's sake, contained an enormous amount of cyanide. The infinitesimal quantity detected in the former case can be explained by the fact that the supposed homicidal gas chambers were in fact morgues for preserving bodies, and such morgues could have been occasionally disinfected with Zyklon B. The British historian David Irving enjoys great prestige. Zundel thought of asking him to testify, but there was a problem. Irving was the only partially a revisionist. The thesis that he defended, for example, in Hitler's war, can be summed up as follows. Hitler never gave an order for the extermination of the Jews, at least up to the end of 43, and was kept in ignorance of that extermination, and only Himmler and a group of about 70 or so persons were aware of it. In October of 1944, Himmler, who wanted to get into good graces of the Allies, gave an order to cease the extermination of the Jews, according to David Irving. The writer met Irving in Los Angeles in 83 at a convention of the Institute of Historical Review, where he challenged him by asking several questions about proof to support his thesis. Then the writer published an article entitled A Challenge to David Irving. He tried to convince this brilliant historian that logically he could no longer be satisfied with a semi-revisionist position, and to begin with, he challenged him to produce Himmler's order to stop the extermination, an order which never existed. Later on, he learned from various sources that Irving was undergoing a change that moved him in the direction of revisionism. In 88, Zundel became convinced that the British historian was only waiting for a decisive event to take the final step in their direction, the revisionist direction. And after arriving in Toronto, Irving discovered in rapid succession the Leuchter Report and an impressive number of documents that Zundel, his friends, and the writer had accumulated over the course of several years. And the last reservation of the last misunderstandings melted away in the course of a meeting, and he agreed to testify on the stand. In the opinion of those who were present at the two trials in both 85 and 88, no single testimony except that of Fred Leuchter caused such a sensation. And for more than 3 days, Irving engaged in a sort of public confession, took back all that he had said about the extermination of the Jews, and without reservation adopted the revisionist position. And with courage and honesty, he showed how an historian can be brought to revise profoundly his views on the history of the Second World War. Sundel had promised that his trial would be the trial of the Nuremberg trial, or the Stalingrad of the exterminationists. The unfolding of those two long trials proved him right. Even though the jury, instructed by the judge to consider the Holocaust as an established fact, which no reasonable person could doubt, finally found him guilty, but Sundel had already won. It remains for him to make it known to Canada and to the entire world. The media blackout of the 1988 trial was almost complete. The Jewish organizations campaigned vigorously for such a blackout and even went so far as to say that they did not want an impartial account of the trial. They did not want any account of it at all. The paradox is that the only publication which reported relatively honestly about the trial was the Canadian Jewish News. Sundel and the Lucta Report have left a profound mark on history. Both will be remembered for many years to come. Final segment coming up. I'll be right back. I hope you're digesting this, folks, because Canada and the rest of the world and the United States is a police state. And yes, this is an administrative court along with the rest of them. Be right back.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets. Even with a growing audience every day, RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcast. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page and share it with your friends and family, because you can handle the truth.
For the past 14 years, it's been my privilege to host the National Intel Report on RBN, to offer a platform to interview exceptional guests, to provoke critical thought, and examine evidence, whether real, fake, or somewhere in between, and allow our audience to call in and participate with your input and questions, in order to help us all reach an educated decision and arrive at our own truth. Our world has changed. It's now been turned on its head. Real is now considered fake, and mainstream fake is now pushed as real, rather than any clear thinking, consensus, or rationale.
Those few remaining beacons of light, the ones still shining through the mainstream media lies, propaganda, and deception, are being viciously attacked at every level through attempts at censorship, threatening advertisers, jailing hosts, and even killing journalists brave enough to speak the truth to you. We are in a war for our very freedom and existence, and through these despicable acts, freedom haters, collectivists, and communitarians have shown they will stop at nothing to blot out these last few beacons of light. Truth is becoming increasingly more difficult to unmask, just as the term unmasking itself is spoken by those usually anonymous sources. They promote their lies, wishing to mask the truths by ignoring it, vilifying it, or conspiratorializing it into a black hole abyss.
Regrettably, RBN has reached the tipping point, and through internal audit and actuarial review, it has now been determined that the only life raft of survival to this network is to go the way of PBS, that being audience-supported. Like a cornered animal, the left with veracity is pulling out all the stops with every effort to effectively blacken our beacon forever. Help us, folks. Help yourselves. Don't let our light stop shining. Our motto has always been, because you can handle the truth. It's time to review your budget, folks. If you want the truth to keep flowing through RBN, go to republicbroadcasting.org and become a regular monthly donor of 30, 40, 50, or 100 or more a month and ensure you keep the truth flowing.
American Awakening, Michael Herzog, your host, you're live from the Valley of the Sun. Okay, finally got the email from Steve Elkins. Actually, my mailbox blew up with about four in a row, so I'm just going to use one. The police can only ask for your ID if you are being accused of a crime or if you are being charged with a crime. They have to identify your crime if they wish to hold or detain you. If they cannot give ample reason of a crime being committed, then they cannot detain you. Ron McDonald and Steve Elkins have spoken on this topic many times. The police are using intimidation and believing that you don't know your rights as a citizen and don't know the law for detainment slash arrest. Yes, we are living in a police state. Send me the clip for my archives. Send me the clip for my archive. Okay. The clip of what, Steve? My show? I don't know. All right. Anyway, getting back to this, though. Yeah. All right. So Ernst Zundel made a profound impact on the entire revisionist movement. And although he was convicted and they threw out the testimony of Fred Luchter, the evidence, the facts, the truth stands for itself. Now, as I mentioned earlier in the week, this weekend, if I have the time, I'm going to see if I can go back through this documentary and kind of put my own tweaks on it, chronologicalize it, if that's a word, into kind of a shorter version, if that's possible, and give you an outlined look at who Hitler was, why he did what he did, the position he was in at the time, the position of Germany as a whole at the time, the reason he joined the party, the reason they called it the National Socialist Party, the flag that he designed, which Hitler did design that flag, he was an artist, okay, and why he did what he did to try to gain back some sense of sanity in Germany, because it was turned upside down. It had been turned into a den of brothels and homosexuality and so forth. Okay, he righted the ship, put 7 million people back to work, and turned the economy around to the point where in a period of 2 years, he was actually named Man of the Year by Time magazine. Now, how did it go from that to him being such a reviled and evil man? Well, it's your opinion, and it's your decision. I'm just going to present some evidence for you when I redo this thing, if you don't go in and watch it for yourself, that'll cause you maybe to just sit back and think, is what we're being told and spoon-fed for all these years really the truth? And that's your decision, folks. It's not mine. You know, I've looked at both sides of the coin, and I've also looked at the sign that they changed in Auschwitz three times, where I believe the first time it said 4 million Jews had died there in 1946 or 7, and now it's down to, what, a million? So that's 3 million right there. But so 6 million minus 3 million is 3 million. What happened to the other 3 million? According to the theory, it's still 6 million. The math doesn't even add up. So, you know, I'm open to questions, thoughts, comments, arguments, whatever somebody wants to put out there. But trust me, I'm not through researching it. End of another day. Thank you for listening in. I'll see you same time, same station tomorrow. Stay out of trouble and bye for now.
With doubt, there's nothing left for me to figure out. I've paid a price, and I'll keep paying. I'm not ready to make nice. I'm not ready to back down. I'm still mad as hell, and I don't have time to go round and round and round. It's too late to make it right. I probably wouldn't if I could, 'cause I'm mad as hell. Can't bring myself to do what it is.
There is an ongoing war right here in America. Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality.
to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.